the old way. I could never go back to not knowing what I was. But did that glorious moment of revelation really change anything? I don't know. Sometimes I don't think so. I may have a name for what I am now, but I'm just as confused and out of place as I was before. And if today is any indication, I'm still playing out that scene in the toy store, trying to pick the thing that will cause the least amount of drama, and not having much success. Which leaves me with this question. What would it take to change something? I rub my burning eyes and stare at the question I just typed out. As I read, the words seem to lose their meaning. I glance at the clock. Holy crap, single follower, it's almost 2 a.m. I guess we'll have to wait for an answer to that question. Good night, blogler. Hashtag genderfluid, hashtag genderfluidproblems, hashtag genderdysphoria, hashtag against me. I click post and lean back against the wall. I haven't thought about that day in the toy store since I was a kid. I'm not even sure I remembered it until I typed it out. But now the details hover fresh and vivid in my memory. The rough denim of my dad's jeans against my cheek as I clutched his leg. The dark lines that formed between his eyebrows as I looked up from the toy packages seeking his approval. That sensation of compression, of being trapped, of knowing there was something wrong with what I wanted, and that I had to hide it from everyone, especially my dad. And then, sitting there on my bed, remembering, it's like a dam breaks, and a dozen other memories flood my mind at once. Staring at my reflection in one of those angled shoe store mirrors when I was 6 or 7, thinking there was something wrong with my body. Glancing up to gauge my dad's expression as we picked out books in the children's section at Barnes & Noble. Riding home from the salon with my mom, hating my new haircut. Sorting through paint swatches the summer we moved here, watching her face for that smile of validation as I picked out colors for my room. Struggling to choose the right 8th grade electives, shopping for clothes, all the decisions I made to hide the feelings I didn't understand, and every single choice altered by the fear that I would choose wrong, and that my parents or my teachers or the people at my school would reject me. My whole life designed around hiding. But today, even with all my careful forethought, I couldn't hide. People at school still knew something was different. I grab my phone and turn on the selfie camera so I can look at myself. I run a hand through my messy hair, brushing my bangs out of my eyes and watching them fall right back into place. A cracked image stares back at me, and it doesn't look anything like I feel. The clock on my laptop changes from 1:59 to 2, and I decide I'd better try to get some sleep unless I want to wake up tomorrow looking like an androgynous harbinger of the zombie apocalypse. I'm about to log out of Blogler when a little red envelope icon appears in the upper right-hand corner of my screen indicating I have a new message. I click it, and a new window pops up. Anonymous. You're a fag. And suddenly I feel very awake. Alex. Dear Anonymous, while I'm eager to illustrate for you the difference between sexual orientation and gender identity, I think we had better start with a more fundamental concept. Apostrophes. What you meant was, you're a fag. Your, sans apostrophe, is possessive, as in, your devastating lack of creativity, while your is a contraction of you and are, as in, you're a homophobic asshole. I hope this sheds some light on the misery that is your life. Love, Alex. Hashtag genderfluid, hashtag homophobia, hashtag grammar police arrest this person. I could reply privately, but I decide that this particular Anon would benefit from a little public smackdown. So, with a rush of righteous triumph, I click post. I watch the screen for a solid minute, waiting for a snarky reply to pop up, but nothing happens. Apparently, even the trolls have gone to bed, and so should I. Like leprechaun gold, the triumph is fleeting, and now exhaustion takes its place. I close my laptop, drop my head to the pillow, and fall asleep. Chapter 6. I dream about choosing the Bratz doll and awake with a nearly irresistible compulsion to put a purple streak in my hair. I'm feeling absurdly feminine, like the compass needle is all the way on F, so pulling on my neutral slash ambiguous jeans and tee combination feels particularly wrong, because what I really want to do is put on a dress. The dysphoria is going to be rough this morning. I can already feel the buzz in the back of my head. Crossing the quad feels like one of those dreams where you go to school naked. I keep imagining that the people around me can see how wrong I feel in these neutral clothes. I get to Miss Crane's classroom early and apply a coat of lip balm, a trick I learned from another gender-fluid blogger. It feels enough like gloss to give me a small sense of outward femininity without spoiling my neutral look, and no one else can tell. It helps, a little. That buzz, anxiety or dysphoria, I'm not sure which, recedes slightly, but it doesn't quite disappear. I feel Solo's eyes on me as he walks into AP English, but I don't meet them. Why did he bother pretending to be nice to me yesterday, only to ignore me in front of his friends? I avoid looking at him for the duration of the class, and when the bell rings, I'm the first one out the door. 10 minutes into AP government, the buzzing sensation starts to intensify. My arms feel particularly wrong, too skinny and angular for how feminine I'm feeling, so I pull my hoodie out of my bag and put it on, tugging down the sleeves. It doesn't make much difference. I cross my legs at the knee, sometimes a shift in posture helps, but today it's not bringing any relief. French passes in a blur. All I can think about is trying to cross the quad feeling like this, or worse, walking the gauntlet. My heart is beating in my throat now, and a numb tingling blossoms in my cheeks and the tips of my fingers. It's starting. But I know what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to close my eyes and picture the whiteboard. I'm supposed to paint it black with my mind until there's nothing left but a calm, quiet void. I close my eyes. I dip my imaginary paintbrush into the surrounding blackness and begin to paint the board with long, slow strokes. Long, slow strokes. I'm 3/4 of the way to the right edge, almost done, when a patch of white appears on the left border. The black is dripping away, revealing more and more of the whiteboard beneath. This always happens. I've never once succeeded in painting the whole board black. Sometimes the exercise manages to calm me anyway, but this time it's not working. My face is completely numb now, and the tingling has spread through my hands all the way up to the wrists. My shortness of breath must be audible, because the pretty girl with long blonde hair who sits in front of me, Casey Reese, keeps looking over her shoulder at me. As I pass her on my way out of class, she asks, "Ça va?" "Yeah, thanks," I reply. But I'm not okay. My vision is starting to tunnel. I'm not thinking, just putting one foot in front of the other. And before I know it, I'm halfway down the stairs to the cafeteria. When I realize where I am, 10 yards from the gauntlet, part of me wants to turn and run, but I don't. I continue forward, eyes on the ground, drawing my shoulders up toward my ears as if I'm bracing for impact. I've covered most of the distance to the cafeteria line, and there have been no taunts yet, nothing thrown. Maybe the novelty of harassing the new kid has worn off. As I pass Solo's table, I'm tempted to glance over and see if he's watching, but I keep my head down instead. It's not much farther. And then I'm through. I make it to the outdoor hallway and break into a run. The concrete wall of the auditorium blurs past as I round the corner. Just ahead, there's a wheelchair ramp by the side stage door. It's protected by a low wall about 2 feet high, just enough to conceal me if I lie flat on my back. Finally, I make it, Doc Martin squeaking as I come to a stop on the smooth concrete. I bend over, chest heaving, hands gripping the aluminum safety rail. I try to slow my breathing. But then a hand touches my shoulder and I flinch hard. "Take it easy," a voice says. My eyes are blurred with tears, and I draw one still numb hand across them to clear my vision. The figure standing before me is the pale boy from government I saw sitting with the hardcores yesterday. The one with the long nose and the lip ring. He's standing on the ramp, hands up in a gesture of surrender. Despite the heat, he's wearing that same black coat. Circular sunglasses with mirrored lenses obscure the blue eyes I remember from yesterday, and I can't tell if the look on his face is more surprised or amused. There's something soft about the curve of his jaw, and the neck of his t-shirt is cut low to reveal. And that's when I realize. He's not a boy, he's a girl. "I'm sorry," she says, lowering her hand slowly, "but you've discovered my secret lair." She gestures at the ramp. "And now I'm afraid you'll have to pay the toll." I stare at her, speechless, gasping for breath. "I accept juice boxes, Amazon gift cards, and narcotics," she says. Then, in response to my blank look, she adds, "for the toll." I recognize that it's a joke, but I don't manage to laugh. My face is still numb, and my heart is beating a frantic tattoo against my breastbone. The girl seems to realize something is wrong because her expression softens. "Hey," she says, pulling down her sunglasses to regard me with those bright blue eyes. "Hey, sit down." She moves to help me sit on the ramp. Well, it's more like I fall and she catches me, and then she pulls off her backpack and produces a juice box. "Here, drink this." She punches in the straw and hands it to me, and I drink. My heartbeat slows. The tingling recedes a little. She sits there watching me patiently. I expect to find her gaze invasive, but there's no threat in her eyes, just curiosity. And something else, something strangely comforting. Her voice is high-pitched and doesn't match her punk boy wardrobe, but despite my initial mistake, I'm certain she identifies as a girl. Maybe it's the confident way she wears her low-cut shirt, or the angle of her neck as she cocks her head at me. But beneath these superficial observations, there's just a strong intuition. What I'm not certain about is how she views me. When a girl sees me as a guy, I usually feel dismissed as unworthy, or at best as non-threatening. When a girl thinks I'm a girl, I get the feeling she's comparing and judging me. But this girl isn't doing any of those things. Her posture is open, her body relaxed. And even though her eyes are hidden behind mirrored lenses, there's an intimacy about her expression that penetrates my wall of anxiety and sends a shiver through me. But a shiver of what? I don't know. "Are you diabetic?" she says. I shake my head. She frowns. "Are you having a psychic vision?" I shake my head again, feeling the hint of a smile curl the corners of my mouth. "I can wait," she says, glancing at her wrist in a gesture of feigned impatience. A slurping sound informs me that I have finished this juice box, which is odd because I don't remember tasting it at all. The girl pulls another out of her backpack and offers it to me. I reach for it, but she pulls it back. "I require a name," she says. I smile. "Your parents didn't give you one?" She opens her mouth in mock surprise and leaps to her feet. "The creature speaks," she says, standing and shouting down at the parking lot below. "I hath revived it with mine purple potion!" I glance up nervously, checking to see if anyone's looking at us. Is this girl making fun of me? I can't tell. But the last thing I want, the last thing I can handle right now is more attention. "Listen," I say, "please don't..." But Lip Ring Girl is now making a 4-point bow, blowing kisses to an imaginary audience. "I'd like to thank the Academy, my fans, my team at Minute Maid who..." At this point, I reach up, grab her by the sleeve, and yank her back down onto the ramp. "Riley," I say, exasperated. "My name is Riley. Please, just don't attract any more attention." "Right," she says, straightening her collar. "Riley Kavanaugh." She knows my name, too? At the look on my face, the girl puts her hands up again. "I'm not a stalker. Brennan said your name in government yesterday." She leans in. "He called on you, and I tried to bail you out, remember?" I nod. "Yeah, thanks." "Then you pulled that obscure factoid out of thin air. Maybe I ought to make you tutor me as partial payment." She tilts her head and squints like she's examining me. After a moment, she nods. "I'm Beck." I blink at her. "Short for Rebecca?" She closes her eyes for a moment and lets out an exasperated sigh. "Ah, Laybeck," she says, "is French for beak." She gestures to her face. "I have a large nose, beak-like, one might say, therefore, Beck." I frown. "Who could have possibly given you that name, some mean French kid?" "Absolutely not," she says. "I gave it to myself." I shake my head, incredulous. "Not everyone is born a Riley," she says, and then her thin lips form a delightfully crooked smile. It's contagious. She offers me the second juice box, and I take it. "Did you follow me behind the building?" "Yes, I did," she says, sounding completely unperturbed. I take a long sip through the straw. "Why?" "After yesterday, I didn't think you'd come anywhere near the calf again. I told myself that, if you did, then you were the kind of person I wanted to meet." She inclines her head, like a Renaissance courtier. "Well met, Riley Kavanaugh." She noticed me? 2 days in a row? I gape at her, then realize what I'm doing and clamp my jaw shut. "So," she says, glossing over my awkwardness as though this sort of thing happens to her all the time. "Your transfer?" "Yeah." "Where from?" I hesitate, then say, "Immaculate Heart." Beck starts to laugh, something between a giggle and a chuckle. I feel myself blush. I start to get up, but she grabs my hand. Her fingers are cold, her palm smooth, and her touch sends goosebumps up my arm. I wasn't laughing at you, I promise. Look. She opens her peacoat, revealing the graphic on her t-shirt. A large black cross inside a red circle with a diagonal line running through it. Above that, the caption reads, Bad Religion. I was laughing at the irony, she says, that I'm welcoming your defection from Catholic school wearing a Bad Religion shirt. Oh, right, I say, relieved. The band. When she lets go of my hand, I feel a pang of disappointment. She pats the ground next to her, and I sit. I thought maybe you were referring to my school's unfortunate nickname. Beck leans in. You realize you're going to tell me, right? I sigh. Of course I am. Instead of Immaculate Heart, they call it I Masturbate Hard. Beck laughs. It starts out as a low chuckle, but quickly becomes a full-on guffaw. Now I start laughing, too. It sounds like my kind of place, Beck says, finally regaining her breath. When I realize what she's implying, I feel myself blush for the 9,000th time in 2 days. Our laughter fades, and I notice that though my heart is still beating harder than usual, the tingling in my hands and face is almost gone. What's your real name? I ask. But Beck speaks right on the heels of my last word as if she didn't hear me. So you're not diabetic, she says. Were you, like, about to have a seizure? Is it epilepsy? I open my mouth to reply and the bell rings, a long, ugly wail. It's how I imagine the lights-out buzzer sounds at Folsom Prison. Beck gets to her feet and offers me a hand. I take it. She pulls me up and we just stand there looking at each other. Finally, I can't take the silence anymore. Saved by the bell, I say. She blinks. You're better than a cliche. My stomach does a flip. I almost ask her, how do you know? But at the thought of saying the words, my face goes hot as a match head. Unable to meet her gaze any longer, I glance down at the unopened juice box in my hand and offer it back to her. Keep it, she says, then turns and walks down the ramp. Chapter 7 Mom's school had an early out day, so I'm not surprised to find her minivan already in the driveway when I get home. But what I don't expect is the unfamiliar red Mercedes that's parked next to it. If Mom's having some kind of campaign-related meeting, I don't want to get drawn into it, so I enter the house as quietly as I can. I hear voices drifting up from the kitchen. She's definitely not alone. I turn to head upstairs to my room, and then the door to the downstairs bathroom opens. A short girl about my age with long brown hair steps out. She looks up, and my mouth drops open slightly in surprise. It's the girl who called me it. Hastily, she tugs down her sleeves and folds her arms, and then she appears to recognize me too. Hi, she says, but it sounds more like a threat than a greeting. Hi, I reply. I'm about to ask what she's doing in my house when a voice calls from the kitchen. Sierra, come in here. I want you to show Miss Kavanaugh how the tea tree oil cleared up those blemishes. The girl, Sierra, closes her eyes, shakes her head, then turns and walks back toward the kitchen. I'm already heading for the stairs when my mom calls me. Riley, did I hear you come in? I grip the banister. I don't want to go in there, but now I don't really have a choice. Yeah, Mom. Come in and say hello. Cautiously, I approach and peek around the corner. With her tight red dress and long, shiny hair, Sierra's mom looks more like an older sister. She's seated across from my mother at the table with the case of little glass bottles between them. The kitchen smells like a potpourri factory. Look at the size of these blemishes, she says, swiping through photos on her phone. Mom is trying to be polite, but I can see that she's embarrassed. Sierra's mom continues enthusiastically. You know teenagers, they eat junk all day and refuse to take care of their skin. But this stuff works like a miracle. Sierra, turn around, show her what it looks like now. Mom, Sierra starts to protest, but her mother flaps an impatient hand at her. Reluctantly, Sierra turns, and her mother lifts up the back of her shirt. Now I'm embarrassed, and I start to retreat into the hallway, but it's too late. Sierra makes eye contact with me. I expect her to shoot me a dirty look, but she just grits her teeth and looks away. When her mother finally lets her sit down, I take a half step into the room, trying to act as if I haven't been watching the whole time. My mother makes the introductions, which I acknowledge from the archway. Sierra runs the peer tutoring program, my mother says. Maybe you could join. I try to hide my revulsion at the thought of working alongside this girl who so obviously loathes me, but Mom seems to read my thoughts because she shoots me an apologetic look. I glance at Sierra to gauge her reaction, but she's too busy glaring at her mother. Sierra's mom, Mrs. Wells, ignores her, turning her attention to me. "Riley," she says, "you have such fair skin. Are you using a chemical-free sunscreen?" She reaches for one of the bottles. I open my mouth to say something, I'm not sure what, but my mom intervenes. "I know you'd love to stay and socialize, honey," she says, "but you still have a month's work of homework to catch up on. Better get to it." And then, I swear to God, she winks at me. I suppress a smile. My mother just came to my rescue. I forgive the honey immediately. In fact, I kind of want to run into the room and hug her, but instead I turn and head upstairs. I know I should feel bad for Sierra. Clearly her mom makes her life a nightmare, but I can't forget how she treated me yesterday. And it's obvious she doesn't feel bad for me. I pull my copy of The Crucible out of my bag, flop onto my bed, and read until dinner. Mom excuses me from dish duty so I can log more time catching up on homework, but my brain is already fried from 2 hours of Arthur Miller, so I decide to click around Blogler instead. When my dash comes up, I frown at the numbers. Messages 1, followers 58? That can't be right. When I wrote my first post yesterday, I had precisely 1 follower. How could that jump to almost 60 overnight? I click on the activity icon. My original post, Both and Neither, which I put up only yesterday, has been liked, commented on, or reblogged over 100 times. Beneath the hashtags is a stream of comments. BP Buttercup, wow, just wow, Irish Polly, this, Phoebe98, I feel you, Alex. I have to scroll down and read them all. I click on followers and a list appears. There's Queerboy96, Mimi Q, Go West Young Lady, and more than 50 others. All of them are Blogler users who read my first post and decided to follow me. I sit back and stare at the screen as my skepticism gives way to surprised acceptance. I know how they found me, the same way I discovered there was a name for what I was feeling, by searching the internet, browsing hashtags. And honestly, it wouldn't have surprised me if a few dozen people had found my first post at random and liked it, but over 100? In 1 day? I lean in and move my pointer down to my second ever Blogler message. I consider clicking delete without opening it. I don't want to spoil my good mood with a repeat of, "You're a fag." But after a moment, I can't stand not knowing what it says. And I click the message. "Yellow Bedwetter, you are hilarious and super helpful. Please post more." I want to reply, but I don't know what to say. Finally, I just type, "Thanks, smiley face," and click send. I'm oddly touched that some random stranger wrote to me. The idea that my writing actually helped someone else makes me want to do more. So I decide to take Yellow Bedwetter's advice. I open a new post and start to write. New post. My raging hypocrisy. Also, lightsabers. October 2nd, 9:47 p.m. Today, I met a boy. Well, I thought I met a boy. Actually, I met a girl. That's right, I got all prematurely gender assigny, and I was wrong. In my defense, it was the middle of a fairly epic anxiety episode, and she, whom I thought was a he, has these unsettlingly gorgeous blue eyes. No one could be expected to maintain objectivity while under the gaze of those eyes. They were like lightsaber blue. My guts have turned to jello just replaying the scene in my head. Oh, and did I mention the lip ring? Hot. Now playing There She Goes by The Laws. Okay. Given the fact that even I am capable of making premature assumptions about someone's gender, I will attempt to explain this with less than my usual dose of gender-fluid rage, trademark, which, by the way, is the name of my new punk band. The point here is that somebody's gender expression, in this case, lip ring girl's goth boy vibe, doesn't necessarily indicate their gender identity. There are dudes who like to cross-dress, expression, but are still 100% comfortable being dudes, identity, and vice versa. So even if you had x-ray vision and could see through my jeans, what you'd see there, or not see, does not determine my gender identity. Gender identity is not external. It isn't dictated by your anatomy. It's internal. It's something you feel, not something you see. And it can be way more complicated than just male or female. Some people, like me, slide on a continuum between the two. Others, as I've learned via my pathological blog reading obsession, feel like neither or like a third unnamed gender. I can't blame you for trying to categorize me. It's a human instinct. It's why scientists are, to this day, completely flabbergasted by the duck-billed platypus. It's furry like a mammal, but lays eggs like a bird. It defies conventional classification. I am the platypus, Cuckoo-choo. We're all taught from a young age that there are only two choices, pink or blue, brats or Power Rangers, cheerleading or football. We see gender in two dimensions because that's what society has taught us from birth. But are you ready for a shocking revelation? Society needs to change. Hashtag gender fluid, hashtag crushing hard, hashtag lightsaber blue. When I'm done, I obsessively reread, tweak, delete, and rewrite. I want it to be funny, but more than that, I want it to be true. By the time I click post, it's well past midnight. I ought to be exhausted from staying up so late last night, but I'm not. Reliving my encounter with Beck has my mind awake and racing. So instead of going to sleep, I click around Blogler for more than 3 hours. At first, I intend to do some heavy reading on gender issues, but that rapidly devolves into watching funny cat videos and reblogging Harry Potter gifs. By 1:45, my eyes start to droop, and then, at some point later, still curled up with my laptop, I fall asleep. When I wake up Wednesday morning, I'm certain it's going to be a girl day. But then, halfway through English, I feel a pang of dysphoria, a sort of plasticky sensation, this time in my hips, and I start to squirm in my chair. I've been sitting up straight with my legs crossed, but now I put both feet on the floor and slump down in my desk a little. I even let my left foot stick out into the aisle. It feels better. Solo pretty much ignores me the whole period. I'm still pissed at him, definitely, but underneath, I think I'm more disappointed. He glances up at me once, but I can't read his expression. And when class ends, he slips out before I do. On my way to government, I notice I'm feeling edgy. That low-grade anxiety is starting to buzz in my head. The plasticky feeling comes back, and suddenly my walk feels artificial and stiff. It takes me a second to realize what's happening. I'm fluctuating. The needle on my internal compass is inching away from feminine toward the opposite pole, and I've been struggling to compensate with the way I move. Rather than try to fight it with deep breaths or with Dr. N's whiteboard exercise, I decide to go with the flow. I reach into my bag and pull out the beanie I keep in case of bad hair days. I put it on, hook my thumbs into the pockets of my jeans, and lean into my walk a little. I start to feel better on the inside, but I wonder what the people around me think, or whether they even notice. And then I walk into Brennan's class and see Beck, and all my concerns are obliterated by her bright blue eyes, cryptic and curious as a cat's as they flick up to meet mine. A hint of that crooked smile plays across her lips, and I feel a flutter in my chest. It's a pleasant feeling, but totally disconcerting. I try to smile back, but I'm afraid it comes out wrong on my face. I drop my bag and slide into the plastic chair behind her. I want to lean forward to say something to her, but before I can, she turns to face me instead. "Riley Kavanaugh," she says. It's like a purr the way she wraps her voice around my name, and suddenly I can't catch my breath. "Hi," I reply, and feel my face turn purple. I started to say her name, but changed my mind too late and ended up sounding like a complete idiot, but Beck goes on as if she didn't even notice. "Thursday," she says, 7:00. I blink. "What?" "Come to my house at 7:00 on Thursday," she says. I feel the blood slowly draining from my face. Is she asking me out? Without breaking eye contact, Beck gestures over her shoulder at the whiteboard. Written in dry erase marker are the words, "Quiz, Friday." "You can help me ace the quiz," Beck says, "and maybe we can forget about your toll." The pleasant fluttering stops abruptly. Beck doesn't want a date, she wants a study partner. A pet nerd. "I can't," I say, suddenly remembering Dad's fundraiser. "I have a thing on Thursday." "Oh," she says, raising her eyebrows. "Okay." For a second, I detect genuine disappointment, like, I just got turned down for a date disappointment, not like I'm going to fail this quiz disappointment. And now I wonder if I've made a mistake. I open my mouth to say something, but at that moment, Brennan clears his throat and calls for quiet. As Beck turns to face the front of the classroom again, I catch the scent of something sweet. Vanilla shampoo. And all of my neurons seem to fire at once, obliterating any further rational thoughts. Brennan begins his lecture, but I am far, far away. I'm at Beck's house on Thursday night, trying to figure out if I'm her date or her tutor, and discovering that I wouldn't mind being either. Right before class ends, while Brennan is gesturing emphatically at a diagram of the three branches of government, Beck reaches behind her and drops a folded piece of notebook paper onto my desk. Just as I'm about to unfold it, the bell rings. Chapter 8. Beck isn't at her usual table at lunch, and on Thursday morning she doesn't show up for school at all. She must have come down with a cold or something. Sitting alone on the ramp, I unfold and read her note for the zillionth time. It's just the words, "In case you reconsider," and a phone number. In case I reconsider what? A date or a tutoring appointment? I can't tell if she's being mysterious on purpose or if she's already given me some obvious sign that I'm just too socially inept to recognize. I pull out my phone, thinking I'll send her a text to say hi or feel better soon, but my thumbs just hover helplessly over the screen. What do I say? And what if I sound too desperate and she's repulsed? This is why I'm not popular. I can't decode the subtleties of text message etiquette, let alone figure out how to act around live people. My thoughts drift to Solo, who appears to have given up trying to talk to me. Apparently I misjudged him like I seem to misjudge everyone. And instead of keeping my guard up, I've allowed myself to hope that this place would be different. But so far, the only difference between Park Hills High and Immaculate Heart is the clothes. I click off my phone, refold the note, and stuff it into my back pocket. When I get home from school, I drop onto my bed, not even bothering to open my laptop, and fall asleep. The muffled sound of my phone's air raid siren alarm tone wakes me. It's 6 p.m. My parents will be home to pick me up for the fundraiser in less than an hour. I drag myself out of bed and cross to my closet. I stand there, staring at the outfit I have to wear tonight, which is still wrapped in plastic from the dry cleaners. It's the most gendered thing I own, and I hate it. I hate it. I call it my campaign costume. It's a stupid name, but it helps me to think of it like that because that's how my body feels when I wear it, like a cheap Halloween costume that somebody else chose. Putting it on is like a suicide ritual. As I dress, I'm killing any possibility of expressing my other, less acceptable self. Just standing here looking at it triggers a powerful wave of dysphoria. My arms feel like plastic, like mannequin limbs. The tingling starts again in my cheeks and the tips of my fingers. I've got to get this over with. I take down the hanger and lay it on the bed. I tug off my jeans and t-shirt, rip open the cellophane bag, and begin to dress. The material feels suffocating against my skin. I picture myself walking into the hotel ballroom with my parents, deafened by applause and blinded by camera flashes. I put my arms through the sleeves. My hands are shaking. Another flash goes off, and I can't tell if it's real or imagined. I pull fabric over my head, and it seems to rush in at me, clinging to my face like the plastic from the cleaners, covering my nose, my mouth. I can't breathe. I can't do this. Piece by piece, I tear off the clothes and hurl them against the closet door. I stand there, chest heaving, staring at the heap, my breath coming in gasps. And that's when it hits me. This is what I wore the night I went to the hospital. There was supposed to be a fundraiser that night, but Dad had to cancel it because of me. I remember I kept apologizing to him in the ambulance, and his cornflower blue tie got tangled in the IV tube as he leaned down to tell me it was okay. I spent the night at Park Hills Community Hospital, and the next day my parents drove me to Pineview. I fall back on my bed and stare at the ceiling. I haven't thought about that night in a long time. Pineview was terrible, but it was also kind of easy. I felt like the healthiest person there, as opposed to how I felt at Immaculate Heart, like I was the only one who was broken. It feels good to be the normal one for a change, but it's awful to be surrounded by sick and hopeless people. Like being in a room full of the worst possible versions of yourself, surrounded by reminders of what you'll become if you don't get better. If you don't fix yourself. And in those moments when you're sure you never will, it feels like there's a rope winding around your body, tightening every time you exhale. And after a while, you can't even breathe. I feel that way now, like there's something heavy sitting on my chest, squeezing the air out of me. I stand and pace my room, clenching and unclenching my fists, trying to catch my breath, trying to stave off the tingling already making its way up my arms. I can't let this happen, not before a fundraiser, not again. I can't do this. I can't do this. My dad's ringtone cuts through the air, and I jump. The phone rings again, and I grab for my jeans, which are still crumpled on the floor next to the bed. As I pull my phone out of the back pocket, a slip of paper drops to the floor. I answer the call, and my mother's voice says, "Riley?" But I don't reply immediately. I'm still trying to catch my breath. I can tell I'm on speakerphone in the Lincoln because I hear my father berating another driver in the background. Somehow that grounds me. "Honey, are you there?" "Yeah, Mom, hi." "We're on our way. Are you dressed?" "Almost." I glance at the clothes piled against the closet door, then look down at the piece of paper that fluttered to the floor. Beck's note. "Well, you'd better hustle. We'll be there in 15 minutes, and we cannot be late. Your father..." I put Mom on speaker, then set the phone on my bed and bend over to pick up the paper. Mom rambles on in her wife of congressman voice, but I've checked out. "In case you reconsider." "Mom," I say, attempting to interrupt her stream of nervous chatter. "Mom!"
"Yes, Riley, what is it?"
"I can't go."
"What?"
"I can't go to the fundraiser tonight." There's a long pause on the other end. Finally, Mom speaks.
"Is it... are you..."
She thinks I'm having another episode, which I sort of am, but she doesn't need to know that. "No, Mom, it's nothing like that. I kind of made plans." No one says anything for a good 10 seconds. I hear the traffic on the freeway. I hear keys clicking against the dash panel. And then my dad's voice erupts from the speaker. "You made plans?" I can almost hear him throwing up his hands. "Unacceptable, Riley. The election is 5 weeks away. Family matters to these people. We have a I have a study date." I blurt the words without thinking. "A date?" he says. I smack my palm against my forehead. Of course that's what he'd react to. I shouldn't have used that word. Why did I use that word? "No, no, it's not a date. I don't know why I said that. It's just studying." I hear my parents whispering to each other, but I can't make out the words. Then Dad says, "Studying for what?" "I have an AP government test." Technically, I'm telling my parents the truth. It feels odd. "When?" Dad says. He's asking for details. That means he's considering letting me off the hook. He's actually considering it. "Tomorrow, second period," I say. And then the words start to spew out of my mouth like noodles from my mom's pasta maker. "Brennan's really tough, Dad. He's not cutting me any slack, even though I transferred. Also, I think he recognized my name. I'll feel like an idiot if the congressman's kid doesn't ace the first test." More whispering. "Where are you going?" Dad asks. "Will there be parental super..." I hear a thwack on the other end. "Ow! What? Sharon?"
"Riley?"
"Yeah, Mom." "You can go on your study date." "It's not a date, Mom."
"Okay, it's not a date. Your father and I think it's great that you're making friends."
"Who is it?" Dad asks.
"Just someone from my government class.
Boy or girl?"
"Sean!"
"All right, all right." Mom clears her throat, then says, "Study hard, and we'll see you after the event." "Home by 10, Dad says.
"Okay," I say.
"Bye, honey."
"Bye."
The call ends, and I stare at my phone in fascination and disbelief. It actually worked. I don't have to go to the event. Overcome with relief, I collapse onto my bed. I play back the phone call in my head and decide it was probably the most normal conversation I've had with my parents in years. Except for one part. Boy or girl? My dad was about to ask before Mom cut him off. Boy or girl? The question rings in my head, the implications echoing around the inside of my skull like a ricocheting bullet. Dad was probably asking because he suspects I'm gay. That's not so bad, especially since he seems open to talking about it. But then Mom cut him off before he could ask. Why? Is it because she's not okay with it, or because she suspects something more and didn't want to open a can of worms right before an event? A bark of laughter escapes me. I don't know why, but just now the thought that my parents are trying to figure me out strikes me funny. They have no idea what's actually going on with me. And for now, that's how I want it. I unfold the note and read it again. Beck's writing is nearly illegible, a tangled scrawl of black letters. "In case you reconsider." She wrote it, so she must have wanted me to come over. But then she went AWOL. She might be sick or out of town, or she might be home waiting for me to call. Just the thought of it heats up my cheeks. I turn my head to glance at my laptop. I could just stay here, reread the chapter summaries, and then burn 5 hours on Blogler and tell my parents the studying went well. They'd never know the difference. But then I remember Beck's bright blue eyes and the cold, smooth touch of her hand on mine. I take a deep breath and punch in the number. The phone rings. It rings again. I end the call. Apparently, I can't do this either. I stare up at the screen, trying to decide if I should call again, and then the phone surprises me by ringing in my hand, and I drop it on my face. It glances off my chin, bounces on the mattress, slides across the carpet, and comes to rest under my dresser. It rings three more times as I scramble off the bed and drop to my knees to retrieve it. It's way in the back by the wall, and I have to press the side of my face to the dresser to reach it. Finally, I lay a finger on the phone, ease it out from its hiding place, and answer it on the fifth ring. "Hello," I say, slightly out of breath. "You called right on time." At the sound of Beck's voice, my face splits in a grin. "How did you know it was me?" "This is Sam, right?" My heart leaps into my mouth. "Sam? Who?" "I'm kidding, Riley." My heart slides back down my throat into its usual place in my chest. "I knew you would call," she says. "Really?" "Mm-hmm. I spiked those juice boxes with an addictive chemical. I knew you could only withstand the cravings for so long." Even though I'm alone in my room, my whole body heats up. It's like a fever chill. "Earth to Riley," Beck says. "Yeah, I'm here." "I thought you had a thing." "I did. I mean, I do. I mean, I'm not going, so..." I bury my face in my pillow. "Please kill me now. I do not know how to speak English to the human people." Beck says, "You still want to study for Brennan?" The way she stretches out the word "you" makes it sound almost like a panther growl. "Sure," I say, trying not to sound eager and failing miserably. "I'll text you my address." Chapter 9. Beck lives on the older side of town in a neighborhood separated from the more upscale part of Park Hills by Banyan Road, a wide, diagonal street marred by potholes and a defunct train track running down the center. Most of the streetlights on her block are out, and I have to click on my high beams to read the fading addresses painted on the curb. I spot her street number and pull over, suddenly self-conscious about the shiny newness of my mom's minivan, in contrast to the peeling paint on Beck's old one-story house. I get out, walk up to the crumbling concrete steps, and knock on the door. There's no answer. I see light from a TV flickering through the thin curtains, so I ring the doorbell. Heavy footsteps approach, and the door opens. A tall, extremely overweight boy with a shaved head looks down at me from behind the screen door. He's wearing a sweaty gray t-shirt and has a video game controller clutched in one hand. His breath comes in wheezes. "Hi," I say, "is Beck..." The boy cuts me off. "Shh, my mom's resting!" I start to reply, but then he pushes open the warped screen door, and I take a step back inside. The boy squints down at me. It's the look that precedes the question, or the taunt, or whatever is coming. I brace myself for it, and then, to my relief, Beck appears in the doorway. "Thanks, Eric," she says. "I'll take it from here." But Eric pays her no attention. His eyes are still on me. "Are you..." he starts, but Beck cuts him off. "Eric, game. Go." He shoots Beck a death glare, but she doesn't look away. After a moment, his eyes flick back toward me. "Have fun studying," he says, then retreats into the living room. Beck watches him go, then turns to me and says in a hushed voice, "Come on in." An ancient square TV dominates one side of the family room. Somebody, probably Eric, has dragged an old blue couch and a mangy beige recliner off to one side to make room for a white plastic mat, which lies in the center of the patchy rug. Eric steps onto it and unpauses his game. It's on mute, but the screen flashes as he drops clumsily to his knees and starts doing what my father would refer to as girl push-ups. It's some kind of workout game. On screen, a beefy dude in a muscle shirt makes encouraging gestures as Eric matches his avatar push-up for push-up. "My room's back here," Beck whispers, then leads me through the family room and into the hall. We come to a room at the back of the house, and Beck pauses outside the door. "Sorry about Eric being a dick," she says. "It's okay. He's had a rough week. Some guy on the football team is yanking his chain." Immediately, I think of Jim Vickers.
"Who?"
"I don't know, some meathead douchebag. He's fooled Eric into believing he's got a chance to make the team if he loses weight and does a few favors, which probably means pulling pranks that could get him kicked out of school or God knows what else." Beck glances back toward the family room, a tender expression on her face. "I tried to tell him they're just making fun of him, but he won't listen." She shrugs. "Anyway, With a smile and a flourish, Beck opens the door and motions me in. "Welcome to my humble abode," she says, closing the door behind us. This is clearly the master bedroom, but it's tiny, smaller than my room at home. I look around, trying to hide my confusion because the layout doesn't make sense at all. The room is split down the middle with a twin bed resting against each of the long walls. One side of the room has been painted dark gray, while the other side is a painfully bright shade of yellow. Unframed charcoal drawings adorn the walls on the yellow side, and in the corner against one of the gray walls, a battered electric guitar leans against an old schoolhouse desk. At first, I wonder if this bipolar arrangement is a manifestation of some hidden mental illness, but after a few seconds, I realize it's more likely that two people share this room. Across the sliding closet door, also half gray and half yellow, someone has applied an enormous rainbow decal that seems to bridge the two halves of the room. I can't imagine Beck putting up a sticker like that. "I had a sister," Beck says, and I jump. I had almost forgotten she was in the room with me. "Oh," I say. "She died a while back. I keep it like this to remember her. I hope that doesn't freak you out." "No," I say, "not at all. But it kind of does." Beck is looking at one of the charcoal drawings, a portrait of a horse standing behind a split rail fence. In the background, heavy storm clouds gather. "Are these yours?" I ask. "Oh, God, no, I can't even draw stick figures." She turns, smiles at me. I set my bag down on the desk chair and gesture at the guitar. "Do you play?" "Yeah, not great, but good enough for rock and roll." A sudden image of Beck on stage, thrashing away at this red and black duct-taped guitar, sends a wave of heat through my midsection. My eyes lock with hers, and for an unknown interval of time, I'm lost in bright blue. Finally, Beck breaks the spell. "I guess we ought to study, huh?" I look away. "Yeah, totally," I say, reaching into my bag to get my laptop. "So did I miss anything while I was out?" "Not much." I set my computer on the desk and push the power button. "Actually, I don't know. I've sort of had a hard time paying attention in class. There's a lot going on." "I know what you mean," Beck says. "So how come you weren't in school the past few days?" Beck looks away. "My dad travels a lot for work," she says. "Sometimes I get to go with him." "Oh, is he still traveling?" "He doesn't live with us," she says, crossing to push in an open drawer hanging out of her dresser. She lingers there for a second with her back to me, and I decide to change the subject. "Do you have Wi-Fi?" I ask. And then I think about the old square TV and the crumbling steps out front, and I'm suddenly embarrassed that I brought my brand new Mac. But Beck is unfazed. "Eric hacks it from our neighbor. He's a savant with computers." She holds out her hands for the laptop. "He has to tweak your settings." Reluctantly, I hand it over. While Beck is out of the room, I resist the temptation to do any serious snooping. I do, however, glance at her extensive and scattered book collection, and I'm delighted to find two of my favorites, Catcher in the Rye and Bridge to Terabithia, among the more worn-looking paperbacks. A few minutes later, she returns with my computer, and we're connected. She stretches out on her bed, resting her chin on her palms, while I sit at the desk and open a browser window. I go to the school website and click on Mr. Brennan's page. "So," I say, "according to the syllabus, this quiz will consist of 5 essay questions about how online dialogue shapes the American political climate." Beck groans, "Kill me now. Essay questions on a quiz?" I scroll down. "We're supposed to click through this list of links in preparation." "Well," she says, sliding off the bed, "I'm going to need a drink. You want something?" "What do you have?" She ticks off the options on her fingers. "RC Cola, juice boxes, cooking sherry, drain cleaner. I'm probably going for drain cleaner." I laugh. "I'll have one of those addictive juice boxes. You know, to prevent withdrawal." Beck smiles. "Good thinking. I'll be right back." Beck returns with 2 juice boxes. She hands me one, pops the straw into her own, and then raises it in a toast. "To Mr. Brennan." "And our fragile republic," I reply, and we click our juice boxes together. Beck leans back, eyeing me. "You're funny," she says. "Defense mechanism," I reply. "Like how sea cucumbers vomit their guts at you when they feel threatened." "Do they actually do that?" "I don't know, but I choose to believe it because it's an exceptional metaphor." Beck takes a pull on her straw, swallows. "So you feel threatened?" I blush immediately and completely. "Hey," she says, scooting toward me on the bed. "I'm sorry. I do that sometimes. I push people's buttons." And then she puts her hand on my knee. It's an innocent enough gesture, Or is it? I feel the heat in my face intensify. It's fine, I say. I just have a blushing thing. It's a defense mechanism, Beck offers. Something like that. Well, that's more sanitary than vomiting your guts out, she says. I laugh. Then she sort of pats me on the leg. It's a weirdly maternal gesture, and it immediately douses the fire that had begun to spread through my body with a flood of disappointment. For a moment, when she put her hand on my leg, I thought she was, I don't know, hitting on me? But then it became this weird leg-patting thing, and the energy changed. Ugh, it's so frustrating being totally incapable of interpreting signals, and on top of that, I still don't know how she views me. If she sees me as a girl, am I just, like, a friend? Or is she into girls? Or if she gets more of a guy vibe for me, am I her type? Or am I just some nerd she can flirt with to get tutoring? If Beck notices my reaction, she doesn't show it. She sits back against the wall and says, "All right, teach me stuff about things." We spend the next hour clicking through links on Brennan's syllabus. Half of them lead to clean, white, extremely boring government websites, but the other half link to pages run by various fringe political groups and conspiracy theorists. Most of these are wildly colorful, poorly formatted blogs that look like they were designed roughly the same year Titanic won Best Picture, but the content is fascinating. One guy's blog consists entirely of videos of him ranting about how the Patriot Act was a direct violation of the Bill of Rights. Another guy, who my father would term a nut job, blathers on and on about how there's actually no law that requires American citizens to pay income tax. "What's the point of all this?" Beck says, gesturing at the screen with her drink box straw, which she has chewed into a knot. Half of them seem legit, but the other half look like they're run by the Tinfoil Hat Brigade, which is the name of my new rock band, I say. "Huh? Tinfoil Hat Brigade." Beck rolls her eyes, and I feel my face start to heat up again. If she thought I was even vaguely appealing before, I'm doing an excellent job of changing her mind. In an effort to divert attention away from my apparently repulsive nerdiness, I return my focus to the screen. We only have a couple more sites to go. The next link leads to the homepage of a Democratic congresswoman from Texas. Below her bio, there's a grid of icons, all of them logos of associations that have endorsed her for re-election. One of them is a sparkling, animated rainbow. "What's the rainbow?" Beck asks. So I click it. A clean, well-formatted page comes up. At the top, there's the rainbow logo again, and the masthead reads, QueerAlliance.org, LGBTQ Resources. "Pretty controversial endorsement for a Texan," Beck says. "Yeah, right. I'm doing my best to keep my face impassive. I know this site. I've never been to the homepage, but I've clicked through links on Blogger and read a few articles on it. Mostly, QueerAlliance.org consists of posts by gay and trans community leaders, but I did find one by a gender-fluid writer in San Francisco that helped me a lot back when I was still trying to figure out what was going on with me. In any case, I never expected it to show up on a homework assignment. Below the menu, there's a square photo of a professional-looking woman with a broad smile and short, wavy hair, captioned Mike/Michelle Weston. Next to that is a calendar of events, including several pride festivals and the annual Transgender Day of Remembrance in November. I scroll down. In a section called What's New, there's a list of featured blogs with photos, short descriptions, and links to each site. I scan through them. When I see my David Bowie avatar, I almost drop my juice box. The description reads, "Hiding and Other Social Skills." Alex's online diary communicates the experience of being young and gender fluid with personal stories and humorous rants. Hastily, I click the back button, silently praying Beck wasn't paying attention. How did my blog end up on this website? "I should get home," I say, powering down my Mac. "What, now?" Beck says. She sits up on the bed. "Is everything okay?" "Yeah," I say, stuffing the laptop into my bag. "It's just getting late." Beck glances at her watch. "It's like 8:15. On school nights, I'm supposed to be home by 8:30. It's a lie, but it comes easily enough. "Okay, well, I'll walk you out." My head is spinning as I drive away from her house, thoughts going back and forth in my mind. What are the odds my blog would turn up on Brennan's homework assignment? Did Beck notice my panicked reaction? And then I think about the awkward knee-padding incident and I want to bury my face in a pillow until I suffocate. Was she flirting or am I deluding myself? The thoughts rush in like that, one after the other, disconnected and out of order. I wonder if I had to pull over until I calm down, but I can't seem to change course. Finally, I get home, close the garage, and head straight up to my room. Dad has laid my beds out for me. I swallow my pills, brush my teeth, and crawl into bed. I try to do the whiteboard exercise, but fail before I get halfway through. Somehow I still manage to drift towards sleep. My last thought is of Beck's hand on my knee, and the radiant heat that spread out from it. I have a mixture of strange and pleasant dreams. Chapter 10. On Friday morning, Mom takes me to school early so she can get to her parent-teacher conferences on time, and when she drops me off, the campus seems empty. But as I'm approaching the gates, movement on the athletic field below catches my eye. I squint. It's Beck's brother Eric, standing on the otherwise deserted football field with Jim Vickers. At first, I'm not sure what they're doing. Vickers stands close behind him with his hands on Eric's hips, almost like a dance instructor. He adjusts Eric's stance, then positions his arms, and I realize he's holding a football. At Vickers' nod, Eric hurls the ball, and it sails about 20 yards before falling back to the turf. Vickers says something, and Eric tries again. This time, the ball goes farther. They talk for a moment, and then Eric reaches into his pocket and hands Vickers something, a piece of gum or candy, maybe. It's hard to tell at this distance. Then the two of them walk out of sight behind the gym. I stand there for a minute, wondering why the hell the two of them were down there together. It looked like Vickers was teaching him how to throw, but why? Beck did say that Eric wanted to make the team, and I suppose it's possible that Vickers is trying to help. Somehow I don't buy that. Not from him. Then again, Eric handed him something. Maybe it was a trade for the lesson. Either way, it's probably none of my business, so I turn and make my way across the quad. Solo is waiting for me outside AP English. We haven't spoken for days, not since he denied me at lunch. At the sight of him, anger flares up in my chest. "Hey," he says. I walk right past him and into Miss Crane's empty classroom. He follows. Picking a desk in the middle of the room, I slump down in the chair, drag my English textbook out of my bag, and pretend to start reading. Solo drops into the desk next to mine. "How long are you planning to ignore me?" I turn the page. "A rough estimate is cool," he continues. "I just want to be able to plan my route to class so I can avoid the Medusa death glare you keep giving me." "I don't know," I say, my eyes still on the book. "How long are you planning to pretend you don't know me when I walk into the cafeteria?" Solo lets out an exasperated sigh. "Oh, please, don't be such a drama queen." "I'm not being a drama queen. You completely ignored me." "I did not ignore you. I gave you a cautionary glance indicating that that particular table would not be a good choice for you." "A cautionary glance? I was trying to help." I shake my head and look back down at my book. "Oh, come on," Solo says. "We all do what we have to do to get along. Don't pretend you didn't stand at the top of those stairs and look at every single table and think, 'I don't want to sit with those people.' Ew, I don't want to sit with those people either. Oh, look, those people like sports. They'll never understand my existential crisis." I snap my book shut and glare at him. "That's easy for you to say. No one messes with you. You don't look like I look." Solo bursts out of his desk. "I look like this," he says, gesturing first at his face, then at his enormous frame. "You don't think I had a rough time the first week I came here?" I'm breathing hard and fast through my nose like my dad does when he's angry. Solo points a thick finger at me. "You walk around here like you're better than everyone, like you're surrounded by a bunch of shallow, bigoted assholes." I open my mouth to reply, but at that moment, the door opens and two girls walk in. One of them